All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. It's our news roundtable. We have two breaking news stories. NVIDIA's earnings are out, and OpenAI and News Corp have done a big licensing deal, a quarter of a $1 billion licensing deal. With me to discuss it all, Alex Wilhelm, the new co-host of This Week in Startups. Welcome back to the program, Alex.
Hey, good to be here. I freaking love breaking news. I love earnings. I love media economics. It's like this show is designed for me today. I am the happiest kid in school.
This is why I wanted you as co-host, because I know you love this stuff and I love this stuff. Let's get to work.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Zendesk. The best customer experiences are built with Zendesk. Qualifying startups can join their startup program and get Zendesk products for free for 6 months. Visit Zendesk.com/twist today to get started. Mercury. 90% of startups fail. Just 10 out of every 100 make it. Mercury exists to close that gap, helping companies succeed with banking and credit cards engineered for the startup journey. Join over 100,000 companies banking with Mercury at mercury.com. And Hidden Layer. Generative AI is revolutionizing industries. Hidden Layer's AI detection and response solution secures your generative AI and LLMs from malicious attack, helping you generate more by enabling seamless and secure generative AI. Visit hiddenlayer.com/twist to learn more.
NVIDIA is the bell of the ball. It's the most important company in our ecosystem and on Wall Street as well. So this is a rare thing that occurs where Wall Street is obsessed with a company and it's that same company that's driving our industry. So let's talk about it. How did they do? Overall, what's the reaction? Stock up, stock down? Did they meet expectations? Did they break expectations? Everybody wants to know what the hell's going on with NVIDIA's incredible run.
So somehow they managed to beat expectations and gain more value. And just keep in mind, everybody, that NVIDIA was worth $2.33 trillion going into earnings today. So when I say that it was up 4.5% after hours, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars of additional value now at the company. Jason, the top level numbers are $26 billion in revenue, which was ahead of expectations of 24.7. And it's EPS of $6.12 per share, bested expectations again. But the thing that I think really kind of solidifies what's going on here is a year ago, the company had $7.2 billion in revenue, which is it was a little bit more than a quarter of what it pulled off in this quarter. So that's the scale of growth here and profitability. It's just, I've never seen a business story like this since, I don't know, like Google rolled out ads for the first time. Like it's crazy.
Well, yeah, and just to pause here on this important observation you have, $7.19 billion a year ago, now $26 billion. So it's essentially quadrupled revenue. But it's not quadrupling revenue on $10 million in revenue and going to 40. This is adding, you know, if we take the $7 billion out of the $26 billion, they've added $19 billion in revenue.
Yes.
Year over year. It is extraordinary. We've never seen anything like that. And this is all driven by one thing, AI and large language models and this incredible competition between not only upstarts like Claude, but incumbents like Microsoft, Tesla, Google, you know, people who've been around for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. This is what's driving it is major purchases of H100s.
Essentially, yes. I mean, so if you want to think about the biggest driver here, it is data center revenue, as Jason mentioned, and that was up 23% from the previous quarter and up 427% from a year ago, which is it's just a pace of growth that a seed stage company would love to have. Like you would love to bring that to your board. You just don't see at a company that's like the fourth most valuable in the world, maybe third now. The thing though that I'm stuck on in all of this, because I'm not really that shocked that NVIDIA had a good quarter. We all kind of expected that. But the fact that it was priced in, so it beat expectations, but only gained 4%. You would think, Jason, that with this much outperformance and overperformance, that there'd be more stock market reaction. But it seems that people just kind of expected this level of excellence. So I'm curious if you're shocked by the lack of a stock market pop here kind of post earnings.
Yeah, I mean, zooming out, if you were to look at the 5-year chart for this company, and I'll pull it up here just so people can see it. That really is the story. If you look at the 5-year chart, this is up 2,500%, 250 times your money. So $1 would turn into $250, right? If you're doing percentages.
Yeah.
And so it's up $913. If you were buying this stock in just 2019, not that long ago, you would have paid $36 for what's now a $949 stock. By the way, that's what seed investors are attempting to do on their outlier bets. So there was this public market company sitting there, you know, at the time, its market cap was a fraction of what it is now. It's a $2.3 trillion market cap. It's nothing short of extraordinary. And it really is based upon the language models created specifically by OpenAI.
Yes.
And once people got inspired by, you know, ChatGPT 3.5, it was really what I think people started to 3.5. People started to realize, hey, wait a second, it's spewing a little bit of gibberish here, but when it gets it right, man, it's so compelling, right?
It feels like magic.
Yes. And you ask it, hey, make me a marketing plan. Tell me the history of China, you know, or tell me the history of China as compared to this and whatever. All of a sudden, you're like, wait a second, that's knowledge work. And knowledge work is being done instantly by a computer. And if you've been in the industry long enough, you know enough to squint. And what I mean by that is you give a little squint and you're like, okay, where's this going? And we all watched dial up. I was on a 300 baud modem, then a 1200, 2400, 4800, 9600,
uh-huh.
You know, and then eventually, you know, ISDN lines, T1s. And you're like, yeah, it just gets faster. It only gets better. It gets faster, better, cheaper. And when you looked at that, every single company said, okay, it's going to get faster, better, cheaper. Therefore, what does that do to our core business? And that scared Microsoft. And it scared Google, Apple. Everybody got scared and greedy. When you combine, Alex, fear and greed.
Yes.
These are the two most powerful two of the most powerful human drivers and corporate drivers. When a CEO, when a board gets really scared, they take action.
Yeah.
And when they get greedy, they take action. These are major drivers in business, right? Gordon Gekko, whatever, greed is good.
Yep.
You know, and then fear, you know, only the paranoid survive. There's a reason why those two phrases are so iconic, right? It was Intel, the head of Intel said, yep, only the paranoid survive. And that's the fear part, and greed is good. That's the you know, the basic tenet of capitalism. This one hit both.
Yeah.
If you're Google, we're going to lose the franchise or we're going to 10X the franchise.
Yeah.
We're going to finally be able to give the answer. Those two things combined equaled purchase order.
Yes. And that's going to continue because if you look ahead, they're going to do $28 billion in revenue next quarter, Jason. So they're going to add another $2 billion in revenue. Now, the growth rate's slowing sequential quarterly. But certainly, they're still expecting a lot of growth. Here's the question, though, that I'm stuck on, and I don't have the answer to it yet. All of this revenue at NVIDIA is just cost at your Amazons and your Microsofts and so forth, because they're buying these chips en masse. But they're also working to build their own chips. So is there any chance in the next 18, 24 months that homegrown AI hardware from the major tech platforms, these major cloud providers, can supplant some of their demand for NVIDIA chips? And if so, what does that do to NVIDIA? I think that's probably a multi-trillion dollar question that no one knows the answer to. I don't think they're going to catch up that fast, but certainly they want to try.
Yeah. So there's this concept. It's all priced in. All priced in. I think it's all, the growth is all priced in here. That's why a 4% pop, not a 40% pop. If you were looking for those pops, that was, you know, you would have had to have your finger on the pulse of AI back in, you know, 2022. 2023, and then realize the size of the purchase orders being put in, and then predicting the fear slash greed dynamic that occurred going into 2023. All of these orders are in. There are two possibilities of what could slow this down. Because I think your question is, when does this juggernaut, you know, slow down? There's two things. One, you're correct. Everybody realizes this, and there are people making chips and alternatives, right? And the second is, do we overbuild capacity? Okay, so competition's coming, but you're correct. It's going to take a couple of years for competition to be able to put a dent into this. So let's put that at a 24 to 48 month reality that people start maybe replacing or considering other options compared to NVIDIA. Overcapacity. Overcapacity is the more likely short-term scenario. I think what's going to happen is the models are getting so good so fast that the open source models, the cheaper models, will be able to get certain tasks done on cheaper hardware. And then if all this gets built out, you need a use case. So for self-driving, yeah, building simulations of self-driving or folding proteins, it's never going to be enough capacity. But to tag a blog post with what's this blog post about and put the tags on automatically in WordPress, like you're probably going to be able to do that with like an open source product that can run on your laptop or that's close to free and doesn't require an H100, or one H100 could do every blog post in existence. So that's the more likely scenario is, are there jobs to be done that require this massive infrastructure? And is the software and the companies pursuing that software, do they have those jobs queued up to leverage all this? And I think that's going to be the question, because you still have to build software to run these tasks. What if you build up so much fiber that you don't have Netflix or YouTube to utilize it, right? And so there could be a trough or a plateau. Capacity is so high, you built three nuclear power plants and nobody has plug-in Teslas yet, right? Like, and nobody's running air conditioning, global warming hasn't happened yet. Okay, you're burning off all that extra capacity. I think we might hit a dark fiber moment in AI. I don't think it's the majority chance, but there is a chance we could hit a dark fiber moment. Too much fiber, not enough bandwidth being used.
Yeah, and that's why I think plateau is the right way to think about it, because we may end up with overcapacity. But if you think about how much bandwidth we use right now, I mean, I have essentially a gigabit up and down, and I blast through my total internet usage. It's insane. Essentially, my usage of compute power and internet have expanded to meet whatever I can purchase. And so I think long-term, that's where we're going to end up with a lot of this AI stuff. But in the meantime, if you are building models for the edge that are smaller and so forth, then yeah, you can use different chips and so forth. But investors are really excited about NVIDIA still. I mean, $28 billion next quarter, tons of profitability. And also, Jason, improving gross margin. Like, the business is not only getting bigger, it's getting better. And that to me is just crazy. I love watching history get written. And right now, NVIDIA is doing something that we haven't seen maybe ever.
All right, startups, when you're a business, you know it's crucial to treat your customers right. Unreasonable hospitality should be your goal, right? Great book. And you know who's great at helping you get delivering unreasonable hospitality? Zendesk. We use it. We love it. The Zendesk suite arms your business with all the tools you need to deliver exceptional customer experiences. And it's made just for startups. And they care about startups. It's built so you can build strong relationships with your customers through amazing support experiences and without growing your headcount. So do what Shopify, Squarespace, Uber, Instacart, and J-Cal does. Rely on Zendesk. They're your partner. Software company Unity, they saved $1.3 million with Zendesk automations and self-service, and they saw an 83% increase in their first response time. These companies love Zendesk because it's so easy to set up, it's made to scale as you grow, and they give you all the metrics to make reporting easy, keeping you and your business agile and investor ready. And because you are a startup, they created the Zendesk for Startups program. When you join the Zendesk for Startups program, you're going to get unlimited access to all Zendesk products, expert insights, all the best practices you need, and entry into their amazing community of founders, all at no cost, with the first 6 months free. So there's no risk to you, and there's all upside. You're going to learn so much from them because Zendesk does this better than anyone. So apply to the Zendesk for Startups program and use Zendesk for free for 6 months and get ready to scale with the best customer support. Go to Zendesk.com/twist. That's Zendesk.com/twist.
Going back to your chart, the 2019 to today's growth.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to keep in mind that if you missed Bitcoin and a dollar,
yeah,
you also missed NVIDIA at $35 a share. So congratulations, everybody. We all missed it twice. And this is why I buy index
Placing bets on promising companies, it's a pretty good pursuit, I have to say, because you never know exactly what's going to happen. We didn't know that there would be breakthroughs in AI here at this velocity, right? But yet here we are, and people are ordering these. There's a very interesting nuance here too. And I want to hear about the profitability and the earnings and how margins have changed, if you have that information.
I do.
But the thing that I think is also interesting is the game on the field has made it so large companies with huge amounts of cash cannot buy other companies, right? We put a regulatory environment that says these companies are too big. Let's not let them buy, you know, Whole Foods. Let's not let them buy iRobot or like a robotic vacuum company, right? Amazon got blocked. So you have all of this M&A getting blocked. So then you have Google, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon sitting there with tens of billions, in some cases over $100 billion in cash.
Yes.
And they're still, some of these companies are giving great dividends. They're doing stock buybacks like Apple. And they still have tens of billions of dollars laying around.
Right.
So for them to not be able to deploy it, hey, you know what? Let's build some server farms. Let's spend $1 billion. Let's spend $10 billion. Yeah. Zuckerberg's like, yeah, I'm going to spend 20, 30, 40 billion building out this infrastructure. Who cares? Elon's like, I'm going to build out, you know, tens of billions of infrastructure. So that circumstance led to, I think, boards and visionary folks saying, got to deploy this capital somewhere. They're not going to let us buy. It's not like they're going to let Google buy Airbnb or Apple buy Uber or Amazon buy Uber, which would be an incredible combination. If Amazon Prime and Uber and Airbnb were one company, can you imagine like how crazy that would be? All your commerce, all your deliveries, everything is just merged together. And because you can't do that, maybe reasonably so, to keep the playing field fair, this is just another way to spend $10 billion and deploy it.
Yep.
You know, that money sitting there in your pocket. I remember at one point I was talking to Larry, and I think they had hit Larry Page. Yep. They hit $10 billion in revenue. And he said, what do you think we should do with all the money? And I was like, you should invest in startups. And you know what? They did Google Ventures.
Yeah.
And then they were doing Google Fiber. Sergey was literally running Google Fiber in the backyard of Google. And he was testing ways to rip up the earth and lay fiber faster. So he had like teams of people. You can look it up. It's like pictures of it. Where they had drills, you know, those big circular drills that, you know, rip up the earth real fast. He was having competitions amongst engineers to see who could rip the earth up and lay the fiber faster, to try to just understand from first principles how to do fiber. And they were literally going to fiber to everybody's home, because the infrastructure players, the cable modem people, they weren't moving fast enough. And Sergey had told me that was their way of telling, it was a shot across the bow of the cable companies. Hey, if you're not going to do this, maybe we should do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how desperate they were to try to figure out how to spend the money. So,
well, back then, at that time, interest rates were very, very low. If you go back to the last 10, 12 years, now cash does have some value, which probably changes the calculus a little bit. But I will say, we need more Google Fibers. Like, I feel like that level of like, hey, we've got a lot of money, let's make the world better and business better at the same time, kind of like, dare I call it a moonshot? I feel like we've lost some of that mojo in tech as the consulting people have taken over. But you wanted some NVIDIA numbers. Let's talk about it. So the thing that I am most stuck on is that the company's gross margins improved from 76% to 78.4% quarter to quarter. And that's up just 2.4%, but 13.8% year over year. The company's revenue up 262% year over year, while operating expenses, Jason, were only up 39%. And that yielded just some crazy stuff. Operating income up nearly 700% year over year.
They're printing money.
Yes. Basically, what they're doing is they're taking money from Amazon, Microsoft, and Google shareholders, and they're putting it into their own pockets and laughing all the way to the bank. It's the best business I've ever seen.
Wealth transfer. This is it. We've redistributed wealth from Apple, Google, and Microsoft
to NVIDIA. The thing, though, the crazy thing is, investors are also rewarding the major platform companies for investing in AI. So essentially, they're spending money and not losing value in the process, while NVIDIA takes that money and grows value in the process. So if you own stocks, which we all do, I mean, it's not a bad day to be around. I'm just, again, curious about when this amazing growth will slow down, and then we'll see NVIDIA be stuck a little bit looking for the next growth, because there won't be a similar boom in gaming hardware, Jason, I don't think. So what's the next act? But they are doing a 10-for-1 stock split and boosting the dividend at the same time. So lots of goodies in there for shareholders and fans. So it'll be
a $90 stock? When? When are they doing that 10?
I don't have the exact date, split.
Yeah.
But I think
so they're planning it. Yeah.
What matters is Dow Jones Industrial Average is, I believe, price weighted, not market cap weighted. And so I'm curious if this is a play to get onto some bigger indices and so forth as a company. That's speculative.
I mean, it's one of the great stories of our time. And one of the great things I think about this whole AI revolution and what's occurred is it's got everybody, you know, I think the industry was in a little bit of a lull, like what next? And crypto was kind of a head fake. All these promises, it was going to be a paradigm shift. We can get into that. We got a $1 billion valuation coming up with Farcaster in a moment on the docket today. And we'll talk about that. But crypto didn't work, right? If you look at how inspired people are by using ChatGPT and how much value and how many use cases there are. And then you look at the promise and the deliverable of crypto, lots of promises. Hey, it's going to be better. We're going to have a better Airbnb because everything's on the blockchain, the reviews, the things, there'll be less fees. You'll pay gas fees or whatever. Transactions will be free. But still, Airbnb is Airbnb. Didn't get disintermediated by crypto. But, you know, AI, God, everybody has all these ideas for use cases. Like maybe we could make better images or videos or audio, or we could talk to this thing. We could make my writing better, or it could, you know, maybe make me a better developer. And they all happened. The time between the promise and the delivery in AI is like, it's days, weeks, months. Like somebody comes up with an idea. We have a company, Howie, that like uses AI to book. It helps people book their calendars. So you and I email, we CC Howie, and it's like, yeah, we should get together for lunch. And it's like, here are some proposed dates. And then all of a sudden it's booked, it's calendared, and nobody had to be involved. Like pretty magical, kind of like a faster version of Calendly. And the time between when the entrepreneur pitched that and then people are losing their minds over it is a couple of months. So here we are.
While at the same time, the underlying tech itself is also improving. So the use cases are coming quickly. The new ideas are coming up fast. And also the underlying models are improving. And that's kind of, you know, it trickles down to NVIDIA's shareholders at some point in time. But it is really fun to see. But on the AI front, Jason, the other breaking news story that we have today is that News Corp and OpenAI have come to terms. And right before we hit record today, you and I were just like gobsmacked by the dollar amount here. $250 million over 5 years, not all cash. Some other things are mixed in there, but certainly this is a bigger deal than I expected to see from News Corp and OpenAI.
Okay, so I have questions. Obviously, News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, they got in a big, big fight with Google. Rupert Murdoch had those famous quotes, so, you know, Google's the enemy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then he got into it with Steve Jobs over the iPad and who would own the subscriber. And so I would say Rupert Murdoch is the most old school protecting content of all content creators and all publishers. Second only to say the music industry, which protects their rights in a major way.
Yes.
And Scarlett Johansson, who also protects her rights in a major way, apparently. So for them to be able to iron out a deal with News Corp, who really understands the value of IP, you got to give credit to both parties here to come up with a framework. 50 million is like a crazy number a year. That's a lot of journalists. Like the average journalist at Wall Street Journal or whatever, you know, I think, what else do they own at Dow Jones? Do they own Barron's too? I mean, they own a lot of, you know, News Corp owns a lot. The average journalist, maybe at the Wall Street Journal, some of the highest paid people, 150K, 200K.
Sure.
The high, you know, and the average across their local papers probably brings it down to 100K or something like that. Journalists are not like super well paid, let's be honest.
No. They're not AI developers. Starting pay
for a journalist at Vox is what, 45? Oh no, it was 45. Now it's 55K, I think.
Yeah.
Because they have a union, so you see these numbers. So lest you think journalists are making a killing, the starting salary at Vox, which is a major publication, shout out to Jim Bankoff, who bought Weblogs Inc. for me at AOL, like 55K.
Yeah.
Like if you're a plumber, you make more than a journalist. Just leave it at that. Like a lot more. Electricians make a lot more. You know, you probably make similar to a barista or an Uber driver being a journalist.
At most places. Yeah.
At most places. 50 million. That's a lot of journalists.
Yeah.
A lot of journalists.
If the money does go to the journalism bucket and does not just go to the share buyback bucket. But I do think what it shows here is that if you are going to build large language models, ingest lots of data, and you want to ensure that you have up-to-date information that is trustworthy so you can build search engines, et cetera, or answer the history of China to your earlier point up to today, you need to pay for it. And I'm hoping that this implies that the New York Times, OpenAI, current legal spat will resolve in a similar monetary fashion. And that also that there's a way for smaller pubs to also do well. Because it's going to be a little bit crappy if Rupert gets 50 million a year and everyone smaller than Rupert gets nothing. That would be, I think, an unfortunate situation. I don't know how to solve that, Jason.
I do.
Okay, hit me.
We have a startup we're going to announce an investment in shortly. That's going to be a clearinghouse for groups of publications. So on a very granular basis, and I won't steal the thunder, but we talked about this on All In, I think, a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so Sachs and I are involved in this company. And basically, you know, imagine, you know, I don't know, you own 20 blogs. You could put them together and say, these are the rights I'm looking for. And then people could then, you know, programmatically include it in their long tail of content, right? Without having to get on the phone and do a deal. Kind of like ASCAP does for the music industry, or like if you have a bar, they come to you and they're like, oh, you're playing music in your bar. Do you have a license? And you're like, what's a license? And they're like, oh, let me explain to you. You're committing a crime by playing music in here. If you just, you know, you have this many covers in your place. If you give us $800 a year, $100 a month, you can play music in your place. And people are like, okay. And they just pay it because they don't want to get sued.
Yeah.
The music industry knows how to, you know, sort of scale this. There's $1 billion in subscription revenue at the New York Times now, right? They got 10 million subscribers, something in that range. So I think they're doing over $1 billion. And I think it's $20 a month. So I don't know what their average revenue per subscriber is, but I think it's probably $100 or $200 to subscribe to the New York Times a year. Maybe 200.
So I just pulled up their numbers. Q1 2024 total subscribers is 10.6 million. 9.9 of those are digital only.
Right.
They had about 557 million in Q1 revenue. So a little more than call it 2.2 billion a year.
Yeah. So they're over 2 billion a year. So, you know, they would probably have a bigger deal, I think, maybe than News Corp. I don't know, but this could wind up being low single digits of their revenue mix, but it's additive.
Yes.
They don't have to do anything to service this. It's free. It's all profit.
Yes.
So the way to look at this is, let's say there's 50 million in revenue a year. Maybe it costs them $1 million to service this. So it's 49 million to the bottom line. Sure. It shouldn't cost more than 2 or 3% to just give access to this stuff, right? It's not an expensive proposition. That's going to be super accretive. If they got a 20% margin, if they're making 400 million a year or something, and then you add 50 million, and it could be like 10% boost to their profitability.
Oh, that's absolutely.
That's why I think we could see a virtuous model here, which is, okay, these language models are paying us. We've got multiple ones paying us. It's like this whole new licensing business for them. And if it holds up, which is a big if,
yeah.
But if it does hold up and there's a clean model here, then there's no lawsuits. Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then those companies can be like, you know what? We're not as dependent on ad revenue. We have a 5-year deal here. Okay, next deal, let's do a 10-year deal. Yeah. And all of a sudden, it's like stability in journalism.
Yes.
And you and I have been journalists I've done acts of journalism for a long time. And
you're forgiven. Don't worry. That.
Random acts of journalism. You've been an actual journalist. Like, we've watched this. What a shit show it's been. And we've watched all of our friends lose jobs, the consolidation. I mean, it's a disaster. And so this could be a path out, I think, along with the Apple News path out, which we should talk about as well. Most startups have tight runways. We know that. And you got to keep your finances in order. And it's complicated, isn't it? You got all these tools, bill pay, invoicing, reimbursements. You got so many financial workflows you got to stay on top of. And they're all connected to one thing, your bank account. But the tools aren't integrated. Luckily, Mercury solves this by powering all the workflows from your bank account. Having these workflows powered by banking is going to let you get more accurate visibility into all the money moving around your account. For example, rather than monitoring all these different tools, you can just check in on your bank account and see a real-time view of every outgoing payment and every incoming invoice. And you really want to control how and when the money moves in and out of your business. Why would you send money to another platform to pay your bills? All that third-party processing, you can pay your bills the moment you need to inside of Mercury so you can maximize your cash flow. And you're going to close your books faster. You can avoid all the manual data entry and you can minimize all the errors by just categorizing a bill the moment you pay it. All these details will sync with your accounting software. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. In the end, Mercury will simplify your workflows and make everything tight. It's going to give you more control. It's going to help you work faster than ever before. So apply in minutes, mercury.com, to join 200,000 ambitious startups that trust Mercury with their business. It's elegantly simple yet complex. And it's going to simplify all your finances so that you can get back to running your company.
Yeah. So on that front, the latest news is that Apple News Plus, which came out and that I think most of us forgot about, is actually driving some serious numbers. Now, the scale, Jason, is a lot smaller. The news here from Semaphore is that the Daily Beast, which I'm sure we've all read at least once or twice, is doing single-digit millions a year now in revenue from Apple News Plus, which is Apple's new subscription service. I think they said they're doing about 3 to 4 million this year. And what really hit me in the Semaphore article we have up is that that's more than it was doing on its own subscription business. And that's the key thing here. This is a really big lever for them. Yeah.
See, this is a big deal. Again, it's passive revenue. They don't have to worry about finding the users, et cetera. And what a great licensing deal. Apple is making a ton of money from services. I pay for some Apple One, you know, I don't know if you pay for that, but I have like a family Apple One thing that might be like, I may pay $500 a year or something. It's a big number. It might be 50, 60 bucks a month for me to have Apple TV, Apple News, Apple Arcade, 2 terabytes shared across 5 accounts, whatever. I mean, I got a nice Apple Music and I'm like, this is easy for me to spend. It's the easiest subscription I have. And I like Apple News. I like it because I use Apple Stocks and Apple Stocks is powered by Apple News. So I don't really, and then I'm finding, I don't know if you've had this experience in the group chats or with your friends, people are sending the Apple News links.
I'm starting to see that.
The Daily Beast link. So I'm getting like, hey, check this out, you know, and it directs me and opens up Apple News. So when I start seeing shares from Apple News, you know, it's getting some kind of critical mass.
Oh, absolutely. And the question that I have, though, is the Daily Beast doing well. I'm glad they have a new revenue stream. Huzzah. $3, $4 million a year. Back to your point about what journalists cost and what, you know, journalism margins are, is huge. How many pubs will this work for? Because, again, if it's only top 5 or 10, we're going to end up pretty top heavy in the world of media. And I think media is often best when it's weirdest and therefore most niche. So I'm hoping that this kind of works out for everyone else. The thing is, the ad market is not as bad as people think it is in general, but for media that is journalistic, it's garbage still. And so I'm hoping that these things do add up. Did you see the Vox news? Vox turned 10. Vox is going towards subscriptions. I'm curious if you were surprised by that.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Vox was formed out of Engadget at AOL. Jim Bankoff left. I don't want to say stole, but he stole. he evolved my playbook, the Weblogs Inc. playbook, but stole a lot of the Engadget and Joystick team and created The Verge. And I guess The Verge was like kind of combining Engadget and Joystick into one thing, like all tech kind of geeked them in one and did a great job. And obviously
still does.
And so when I saw they're going to subscription, I did do a tweet about that. It really just has to do with how efficient advertising is in three places. The first is obvious. Google, Meta, TikTok, Twitter, Snapchat. You know, there's like 5 or 6 at-scale ad networks.
Sure.
Then you have a new emergence of what I'll call checkout, shopping cart, basket, e-commerce related ad networks. Amazon is at like $40 billion, I think. Yeah. Uber, Instacart at a billion each. Mm-hmm. DoorDash crushing it on advertising. So these marketplaces are starting to generate, my understanding is like 5 to 15% of their revenue they expect to come from advertising already. And I think that number could go up. And then finally, there's podcasting, which I know I'm like kind of tooting our own horn here because we're on a podcast, but podcasting is like really started. Now, it's smaller numbers. In aggregate, though, advertisers really love it. So you put those three things together, and I'll put YouTube and podcast together, shows, post read ads, whatever. Those are going to win most advertising, and they all have like great tracking, and they're very unique in the world for different reasons. The scale of the ad networks from Google and Meta being close to checkout, and then host reading ads, right? And like just really passionate target audiences. That's hard to beat. That's hard for Engadget, TechCrunch, you know, The Verge. It's really hard for them to say like, buy our ads. And they're like, if you're Samsung, I think I want the Amazon ad. I want my TV and my receiver and Sonos. Yeah, maybe Sonos will put a little bit on The Verge because it makes them feel good, but they're probably better off being at the checkout on Amazon or during search on Google, not on The Verge. The Verge is going to have the least trackability. Engadget is going to have the least trackability, which wasn't always the case, right? Those were like the premier places to spend your money. So I think that's why subscriptions and these licensing deals, they could wind up winning the day.
I agree with all of that. The counter argument is somehow, to this day, television advertising remains simply enormous and people spend ungodly amounts of money to spray very poorly targeted stuff all over television. And so to me, I'm just holding everything you said in my hand and going, yes, you want to be close to intent. You want trackability. You want the ability to you know, really understand the ROI here. And then I turn on my television, and if I see one more State Farm ad, I'm going to rip my TV off the wall and throw it through the window because I can't stand it. Here's the thing, Jason. I'm not in the market for insurance right now. And yet I have seen in the last week, probably 200 paid insurance ads on television because I watch sports. And so I struggle to see like, why can't some of that dumb money land in the hands of your Engadgets and TechCrunches? We could talk a while about why that's the case. But I want to
look back. They do have big scale. They do have big scale on TV, you know, and there's like an old school, you know, group of people who believe in that scale, right? And it's just, it's hard for people to make small bets. It's the same thing with venture capital. You know, it's This Week in Startups where we're talking about it. You know, you see some $1 billion fund and they're like, well, why can't they give like $1 million to 1,000 people? And it's like, it's a lot to manage for the management over there. They would rather do 25 million, 40, $25 million bets than $1,000 bets. Now, in a logical basis, like there could be an argument that you would hit more outliers, but there's also the human constraint of what a human can imagine and manage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the dynamic of larger funds wanting to put checks into earlier companies at higher dollar amounts is partially why the seed and Series A market is so wonky right now. Yeah. And if you're going to do the scaled bet, you're going to have to try to beat YC because they are probably the most active, super early investor out there. And think about how much work goes into each of those cohorts, the brand, the promotion.
I think they have 150 people making 500 investments. So on average, they're doing three or investments for each. And that's just I think that's the total staff is 150.
Wow.
So, you know, if there's 50 partner people, you know, it's like they're each doing 10 investments a year, one a month. That's still a lot of work, right?
That's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of forms.
That's why the forms are standardized and they don't negotiate them, by the way.
Yeah.
And we do that here. I forgot to tell everybody you're here at launch doing the show with me. So you're going to get some inside information, as it were, on startups and some education. So I'm really excited for that for you.
Here to learn.
AI has changed the startup game forever, and companies that are slow to leverage this technology are going to risk falling behind their competitors. If you're not deploying AI inside your startup, and your competitors are, I think we know what's going to happen. They're going to get more done. They're going to move faster. And generative AI is so powerful, but we all know it comes with security risks. There are tons of threats that could cripple your AI investment. So how do you accelerate AI adoption while also managing these risks? Well, Hidden Layer's AI detection and response platform is your secret weapon. It's a security solution designed specifically for AI and large language models. It gives you and your team the tools to see and stop confidential information leaks and prevent malicious code injection and safeguard your models from theft. It's trusted by leaders in finance, technology, healthcare, and even the U.S. Department of Defense. Hidden Layer helps you generate more by enabling seamless and secure generative AI. So here's the easy call to action. With Hidden Layer, go from pause to possibilities and step into the future of secure AI innovation. Learn how to protect your generative AI today by visiting hiddenlayer.com/twist. That's hiddenlayer.com/twist. Where are we going to go next? We got NVIDIA. We got the News Corp. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other things on the docket. What do you want to go next, Alex?
I think we got to talk about Humane AI and the company potentially being up for sale, because there's a lot baked into the story. It's a media story. It's a review. It's a hardware story. It's AI. And I got to say, I'm not that shocked the company is looking for an exit path after its pen came out. Everyone's seen those little pens that Humane shipped. They were expensive. Yep. They had a subscription. They were ambitious, perhaps to a fault. And the reviews are pretty negative. And then what feels like 20 minutes later, Jason, the company is trying to sell itself for $750 to $1 billion. I don't think it's going to get that. But first reaction, hit me.
All right. So like you said, there's a couple of vectors here. Hardware is hard. Consumer hardware is hard. Why is it so hard? Well, you have somebody like Apple, who's just so good at it, that they're going to own the category. You got Michael Dell and Dell Computers. You know, I love them. You know, I always buy Dell and they're just great. And like when I buy a Dell or my MacBook Air, I have like a, like you, I have my gaming PC over here. Uh-huh. I got my Mac here. When I'm doing creative stuff, like the show, I'm on Mac. When I'm working, I like to use my Windows machine sometimes, my giant 50-inch Dell monitor, and I like to play a little Age of Empires 4 once in a while when the kids go to bed and I need to blow off a little bit of steam. It's hard to compete with people at that scale, right? And then there's the long tail of whatever interesting thing you make, like Dropcam or Nest Cams. You can go buy four, you know, cheap hardware versions of that for like $199, or you can buy the $199 one from Google.
Yes.
It's a race to the bottom. So
it's a race to the bottom.
You know, it's hard. Hardware's hard is what we say in the business. VCs don't like to invest in hardware. And all you have to do when you want to judge a category is look at exits. And if I were to ask you, what are the three biggest venture exits for a hardware startup in, you know, from 2008 till now, after the Great Recession, take a minute to think about hardware startups that you saw when you were, you know, editors at Crunchbase and TechCrunch, go ahead.
Nest,
which was Dropcam, $500 million to Google.
Right. Correct. Danger to Microsoft back when they were trying to get their mobile life back together. I forget the year on that. That was
earlier. Yeah,
that's earlier. Okay.
So not
a venture exit, but I mean, Microsoft and Nokia back in the Windows Phone days.
Okay. Yeah, giants.
I'm really digging startups here. I mean, maybe Framework, the laptop company today, is doing well, hasn't exited, but is doing well.
Love Framework. We should talk. I had them on the pod. I really love what they're doing conceptually. The ones you miss were two. And the reason it's so hard is because you kind of forget about them. GoPro and Fitbit. Ah. Fitbit bought by Google, right? They had a really hard time. And then you had, of course, GoPro, which both of those, I believe Fitbit went public before being bought, and GoPro. Mm-hmm. Then you could add a couple of more hardware ones that are still in play. Peloton went public.
And Raspberry Pi.
Raspberry Pi is open source, I think. I'm not sure if there's a startup behind that.
They're going public on the London Stock Exchange. Oh. They're raising $40 million. Yeah.
I stand corrected. Okay.
I just saw that the other day.
Well, that's actually an interesting one for us to double click on, because it's like a platform. I wonder if they make it from the hardware. Who knows?
Yeah.
So you start to put all this together, you can understand why most exits that have occurred are in the low single digits. The biggest ones are in the low single digits. GoPro, Peloton, Fitbit, Dropcam, which became Nest. Those were all $500 million to $4 billion-ish. There was a little weird spike with Peloton, of course, during COVID, where it went to $30 billion, which made no sense. So that's why people don't like hardware. That's why this is such a tough space. These people have a pedigree. So then the question becomes, does anybody want this product? Does anybody want it?
What
like as a consumer, do you want it?
No. And the reason why is not actually the hardware, because I think the actual thing they designed is small enough and sleek enough that I can see myself wearing it. I mean, I'm now wearing an Apple Watch every day, which is enormously dweeby. Yeah, you are too.
Yeah.
I think the problem here is that hardware is hard because you have to nail two things at once, software and hardware.
Yes.
And in this case, I don't think the AI software that underpins what Humane has built is sufficiently good enough to warrant the high cost for the device and the subscription. And so, look, I did not buy the Vision Pro. I'm going to buy the next generation of it because I have more money than sense and I like gadgets. I don't have a lot of sense, just to be clear. But in this case, I wasn't even that excited about it. And I think that's the lethal thing here. And that brings to me the question of who wants to buy it, the company? What is the value that they've put together? What's the IP? I don't know. I don't want to be rude.
Well, okay. So that is a good segue about not being rude. There is, a debate or a micro kerfluffle. I'll give it a micro kerfluffle. It's like a little Donnybrook. It's not a major one. That Marquez from YouTube and maybe The Verge kind of trashed it as a 1.0. And I think they put like in the headline, the worst product I've ever reviewed. I just want to let people know how headlines work. It's just that it's a public service announcement. If the headline is the best ice cream I've ever had, the most disgusting ice cream I ever have, people will click on that more than I tasted ice cream yesterday. So the most disgusting ice cream, the absolute best ice cream I've ever had. And so people can be a little hyperbolic in the headlines, especially on something like YouTube. And so Marquez did the worst car he ever drove, which was, I think, the Fisker garbage. And I think they're out of business now. And then this device. And then people countered that with, oh, but they're being mean to innovators and startups and founders. Okay. This is the big leagues, folks. If you make a movie, you don't get to make a movie for the public and then not take criticism of it. Quite the opposite. You need to embrace and love the reviewers for actually giving you attention. Now, if you want to say this is a developer preview, disclaimer, 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 this is for developers. It's not intended. The price point we're going for is $299, not $999. But that's not what Humane did. Humane came out with it like, this is a finished product. And also the Rabbit. We had the founder of Rabbit on the pod. They came out with it saying, like, you're going to be able to do, you know, order your Instacart and order your Uber. People got it. They weren't able to order their Uber. You got to be careful in how you frame these things. If you want it to be a developer preview, say this is a developer preview. Put it on the box. Put a disclaimer, say you're only selling a certain number of them. And then when you do the demo, say, these are the things we hope developers make for Rabbit, for Humane. And this is what it might look like in a couple of years. You basically play it down. They didn't do that in both of these cases.
No, so they're going after things we already know how to use. If you think about the pitch behind a lot of this AI hardware, it's keep your phone in your pocket. Which honestly, great. I would love that. But then you have to really own up to that and earn it, because people do already take their phone out for a reason. Now, the Rabbit R1 was $200, no subscription. That gives them a lot more space to ship something that's not fully baked. $700 to $800 for the Humane Pen plus $24 a month in subscriptions. So it's Netflix every month for this thing. That's a lot harder. And I do think that there is something to be said for people not understanding the role of media in the world of technology products, because people have become so tribal that they think that any criticism from anyone in the world of media in general is evidence of bias or haters or whatever. But Marquez is well-loved and trusted because when he talks to you in his videos, he's telling you what he really thinks. And the headline was spicy, absolutely. But I don't think his review was actually that far off the mark.
No, I watched the review. It was not like the review was disastrous. It was just like, He actually says hardware is incredibly slick. There's a lot in here to like. That's like literally how he leads. And then he's just like, but it gets a little bit hot. The battery, you have to change constantly. It hangs off everything. It felt like a iPhone 1.0 review, right? If you go look at the iPhone reviews, it's like, this thing's pretty stupid. There's no keyboard. You got a hunted pack. The screen's tiny. It lags. It crashes. Like, it wasn't as magical as it was. It wasn't like, you know, even with the reality distortion field, I think people were a little critical of it too.
They were. I mean, it didn't have 3G. That was a big point. And don't forget, when the iPhone came out, it didn't have an app store. The whole idea of the original iPhone was the mobile web is going to be amazing and everyone's going to build great websites. And then we ended up with the app world. But I mean, really, it was the iPhone 3G that I think really took that from this is a niche thing to everyone's going to have one of these until they die.
And it turned out the app store and apps by developers using the platform, they discovered like the really cool things to do with it, like Angry Birds or a flashlight, you know, like there were like silly things, but people don't remember that the flashlight was an app you bought. It wasn't like built into it, right?
Right. And then eventually we saw a major platform company slowly eat bits of the market, which happens every time out there. But I mean, certainly Apple is not trying to replace the entire app store. But we have a bit of a startup story here on that note, because we were talking about the recent Microsoft event, Build, and they're talking about AI PCs. They're going to put neural processing units in these. They're called Copilot Plus PCs. I think Joanna from the journal calls them AI pewters. We'll see which phrase takes off. But Jason, they have a new thing called Recall coming out that's going to let you go back through your computer and see what you have done in the past. And as it turns out, on this very show, a couple of times, we've had a company on that was called, I think, Rewind AI, and you've sat down and talked to them about this. And so I'm curious, do you think this is like Microsoft coming late to the show and they're going to like take the market? Or is this one of those moments when startups are going to be able to fend off the big tech incumbent?
Number one, it's a pretty terrifying concept. Your entire screen is recorded. And you know, like as I talked to the founder about this, I had profound concerns. I'm like, well, what if you have signal on your screen? It's like, well, that's your choice. It's like recording your screen. I'm like, yeah, but the expectation is signal is disappearing messages, or I don't know, pick Telegram, whatever you use. People are not expecting to be recorded. So you're kind of covertly recording people. And he has a different view of privacy, like many tech people do, which is we don't care, or, you know, like, you know, you gain so much that privacy doesn't matter as much because you just make that trade-off. I guess that would be the fair way to say it. It's not that they don't care, but they think the trade-off's worth it. I disagree profoundly, you know, with these AI pendants that people want to wear, because one of the things, and what was the name? It was Dan was his name.
Dan Sroker.
Yes, Dan. And he also was going after the pendant market. There were two different companies we had on.
Yes.
And the idea behind the pendant was you wear the pendant, it records every conversation. And I'm like, that thing doesn't have a record light on it, does it? Like, nope. It's like, okay, so you're covertly recording me like Michael Cohen, like recording Trump. Like, nobody wants this, by the way. Nobody wants 24-hour surveillance. People who wore those goddamn Google glasses the first time got punched in the mission for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, nobody wants you walking up with a VHS camcorder and being like, what's up? You know, you will get punched. And nobody wants that covertly. So I think it's a little crazy, these concepts.
Okay.
And I think consumers don't want them.
So
I could be wrong.
We're going to find out, because a couple of things have happened since we had Dan on the show. First of all, they have rebranded, they're now called Limitless AI. And what they've done, actually, I watched Dan, this founder, discuss Microsoft's recall feature, because people, of course, were like, oh my gosh, you know, what do you think about this? And we have a clip we're going to pull up in a second. What I think is really cool is they have moved away from what Microsoft is now doing. Microsoft is saying, it's your device. Everything will be local. And what you do on your computer is going to stay there. It's for you. And okay. I'm cool with that.
I mean, that's how Apple's work, right? Like, your stuff is stored local, encrypted. Mm-hmm. Even Apple can't get to it, as we saw with, I think, the San Bernardino shooting.
Yeah.
They wouldn't open it for the government, and they had to use an Israeli company, I believe, to unlock that iPhone, because Apple's like, Tim Cook's like, yeah, no, we don't open phones. Sorry.
Yep. No, but now, Limitless AI, the startup that's rebranded, uh-huh. has built what they call a private personal cloud. So essentially, okay. it now works across your devices and okay. gives you your own repository, which is great until it gets hacked, in my view. But let's go ahead and take a quick look at this clip, everybody, and we'll see you on the other side.
It's easy to imitate the outside of a product, imitate what looks like the way the product should work. But what you can't imitate is the learnings, what took to actually build the product, the innovation, the core problems you're trying to solve. You know, we've evolved a lot in the last year and a half from the learnings we've had from our users. In fact, just recently, about a month and a half ago, we completely launched a new product called Limitless that took everything we've learned from Rewind, invested it in an entirely new architecture that we think is fundamentally better. In many ways, we actually felt Rewind, the approach we took, that we took, and that Recall is taking now, we found it really limiting. And we knew that users really cared about being able to access their data from any device. They cared about being able to use the best AI models, and they really cared about unlimited storage. And at the same time, if we could deliver on those guarantees and give them the same guarantees they had of privacy that they had with a local app like Rewind, but in the cloud, then that would be a breakthrough.
All of that's great. But back to your earlier point.
Confidence or cloud, is that an oxymoron?
Kind of. I think so. Just given my view of cybersecurity, which is that everything's going to get breached eventually forever and ever. The thing that's not fixed by having a private personal cloud is if you're recording with your pendant, what everyone else is saying, you're taking their words and putting them into your cloud. You're taking them. And so I'm very curious about that. But the consumers will decide. And that's why I think this recall feature is interesting for Microsoft, because they must have known that people were going to go, as you did when you first heard about Rewind, oh my gosh, this is invasive. And they went ahead anyways. So presumably they've done the research and the thinking. So we'll have to see if folks actually use it. I probably won't.
I think, you know, every time somebody proposes the Truman Show, somebody tells them, please go watch the Truman Show, and we live in public. It's a nightmare. Go watch the Black Mirror episode. It seems like the Truman Show is a positive thing. Then you realize it's a nightmare for Truman.
Yes.
It's great for everybody else, gawking. It's tragic and anxiety producing to put yourself under that much scrutiny. That's why people right now love the Brave browser. I made the Brave browser my default on everything.
Really?
I don't want to be tracked. I have it, you know, I have my shields up. Mm-hmm. I pay for their VPN and I pay for NordVPN. I have double VPNs. I pay for two VPNs. And NordVPN has a double VPN feature. I'm just paranoid I'm going to get hacked. I have like confidential documents, you know, from startups and stuff like that. I'm vigilant about it. So good. I think there's like a trend to take your cybersecurity seriously. And these kind of things, there is a benefit to it. We have an investment in a company called Recall AI, paradoxically. And it's a browser that plugin that allows you to make a summary of the page you're on and then put it into your knowledge graph. So you have to actively do it. And I asked them actually to, when I have a browser session, put it on, record everything in my browser session so that every page. But what I would do in that situation is I would have a browser that's my knowledge one that I wouldn't do my personal banking in.
Yes.
That I wouldn't do personal communications. And so I would take like a browser instance. Now I'm a vigilant user. And I love that idea of my entire, of this like powerful browser history where like, oh, I had read a story about that, et cetera. So I do like that, you know, delicious bookmarking on steroids with AI. I do think there's something there for that. But I just don't like this idea of recording your whole desktop. It's going to get hacked just like everything else. There's no such thing as like a cloud that's perfectly, you know, private. I think that will get hacked too eventually. And so I do think that there's a big danger here. And then you might also be educating Microsoft. Everybody says the language model is not going to be informed by this. But then I saw the Slack kerfluffle. I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
Where Slack was saying they were training their data on yours and you had to opt out of it. So I think the industry needs to remain vigilant on all sides here. Like, and be very thoughtful about this because there are going to be great gains and there's going to be great losses. The fact that everybody knows where you are at all times because of GPS is so powerful. I'm not ready to give it up, but I do have concerns about being tracked, right?
Did you see that article recently about how there's a new norm in like dating relationships to have like find my iPhone turned on so you can kind of see where your partners are or partner is? And you, of course, people have been caught cheating and so forth. But it just blew my mind because I don't know. When I was a child, we like left the house and no one had phones and we would just go. And that was, you know, you're expected to not be a dumbass and get hurt. And now, like, we're tracking adults. Like, it feels too much to me.
I am claiming you for the Gen X. In the Gen X draft, I'm claiming you, Alex. I think we're claiming you. And we're willing to give up, like, I'm not sure who in Gen X we're willing to give up. But I'm sure there's somebody annoying in the Gen X crowd we will give to the millennials in order to get you into the Gen X bucket. I was explaining this to my daughters because I told them, get out of the house on Saturday. Yes. You can come back in 2 hours. And they're like, what are we going to do? These are 8-year-olds. And I said, go play in the backyard. There's a tennis court. There's a treehouse. There's this. Go play. You can come back. They're like, they came back every 15 minutes to ask me what time it was. And I was like, guys, you're not getting your iPads. You're not watching Harry Potter for the 17th time outside. Right. And you know what? Then all of a sudden I come out, the magic. Not half an hour after, they're painting. They found the paint sets. They got, these are 8-year-olds. The twins, they found the canvases, they're painting, they come back, they got paint on their face pants, they get into all kinds of good trouble. And I said to them, imagine when I was a child, we were kicked out of the house at 8 a.m. We were given a sandwich or 10 bucks, and we were put in the streets of Brooklyn. You know when they told us to come back? The rule in Brooklyn was you can come back when the streetlights come on.
Yeah.
The streetlights were timed to come on at dusk. So streetlights come on, you come home. It was like the bat signal for us. And I do agree, like the Truman Show will make you crazy. I had a friend, Josh Harris, who did a company called Pseudo back in the Web 1.0 days. And okay. He did an experiment called We Live in Public or Quiet. And there's a Andy Timoner documentary called We Live in Public. Everybody should watch it because he went mad because he put in his loft in New York 50 cameras and he put himself under surveillance. And then people were watching him all day, all night, in his shower, everywhere, the bathroom. It was crazy. And he literally went mad from it, just like in the Truman Show. No spoilers, but
yeah, I don't think humans do well with constant surveillance. Like, no. You know, just to record this morning, I had to think about like, do I shave today? What shirt am I wearing? Like, which glasses am I like just the preparation of making sure there's nothing untoward in my background. And that's to record something in one place to one camera in a controlled setting. Now imagine your house. Everyone's weird, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, this should be obvious. Be careful what you wish for. And you always have to ask, is the juice worth the squeeze? And what's the worst possible scenario? And, you know, the worst possible scenario is really bad. So I do like the idea, though, of, you know, some amount of watch me work and I'll get better at my work. And so shout out to David Sachs and his partner, Evan, for Glue.ai, their new Slack killer. It's watching what you do at work. So you can, instead of people saying, here's what I got done today, you're now in our corporate Slack. I just ask people like, please do your start of week and your end of week. What you plan to get done this week, what you got done, start a day, end a day. It's just a ritual for a remote company. 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at the end of the day, 15 minutes at the beginning of the week, 15 minutes at the end of the week. You add all that together, it's like an hour of time. Yeah. 1 hour of time just to have like a GSD, get stuff done, methodology and accountability to your team members. And now you can just ask Slack, hey, what is Alex working on this week? And it'd be like, oh, Alex was working on the new ticker. Alex was working on producing this episode. Alex was doing this. It will know that automatically in Glue.ai, the Slack killer that Sachs made. It knows that you can ask questions to your corporate chat and be like, who was the guest we had on? Or did we ever think about having this guest on? It's like, oh yeah, you know, we invited Humane back then. Here's a link to that thread where we talked about inviting Humane because we've been trying to get them on the program for 2 years. The end. Yeah.
They should come on. They should.
I think they're gonna have to do a post-mortem at this point.
Oh man.
Not to be dark. So I actually helped put together the notes for the Glue show you're discussing.
Oh,
and
thank you for that.
Oh yeah, no worries. But the thing that hit me while I was looking at that is this is like This is not something you could do with Slack, because Slack right now is doing, what if we take an existing product and we try to thread AI through? Glue is, what if we just erase the whole freaking whiteboard and start again and build with AI from the foundation up? And that is, I think, a very compelling way to rethink enterprise software that might be more useful than what we're seeing now, which is a lot of people trying to put a fresh AI coat of paint on an old car, you know? And I wonder how much of the B2B software stack that we all live and use day to day needs to be torn down to the studs or further and rebuilt. And I mean, we'll see how Glue AI does.
Superhuman's new AI feature is also pretty dope. It will summarize your inbox. Kind of cool. You can ask it questions. That's just coming out. Notion has a built-in AI. That's pretty dope. And so I do think it's going to be table stakes soon. And it's just going to things that would have taken you 15 minutes or 5 hours with your inbox or your knowledge graph or in your, corporate messaging, that you would just be like, I don't have time to do that, are just going to be automatically done. So again, the great efficiency of corporate America and our personal lives is going to hit an all-time high because of AI. It's going to be bonkers how efficient we all are. Just even researching stuff, you're going to be able to, I don't know if you've noticed this, but as an editor and as a writer, even at a great publication like TechCrunch, where you're hiring people based on their aptitude in those and their achievement in those areas, everybody seems to be getting really good at writing. Everybody's a good writer all of a sudden. And I'm like, you know what? My whole life, the majority of people were bad writers. And what made me special was I was a great writer. And the difference between me and other writers, an average writer, was just tremendous. And people are like, hey, can you read this for me and write it for me? Because you're a great writer. And now I'm like, everybody's pretty good.
Everyone's pretty good. The thing though, the reason why I'm not concerned about my ability to send my child, because
you're a great writer.
Well, one, thank you. But I mean, the thing that I think matters is AI kind of all sounds the same. It has this it all tastes like chicken to me. And if you look at Grammarly or even just how Notion wants you to write or Docs, they all have a very, very straight line approach to writing. I like to mess around and have fun and abuse grammar a little bit and throw some words that they're going to say are too hard in there. And so I think that there's still going to be plenty of space for humans to put some riz on it, as the kids say. But another thing that I have learned is that people hate writing. And so they want to use AI to do more of it faster and probably better. So I agree that it's raising the floor. I just think the ceiling is still pretty high.
I think the ceiling's high. You're right. Because I am a big fan of the M dash. It's my big comedic device. I'm like, blah, 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 blah. M dash.
Yep.
Drop the bomb. And everybody's like, it's not a J.Cal essay without an M dash or two. And, they're just like, make it a new sentence. I'm like,
no.
Nope.
No.
Nope. It's not a new sentence. And they're like, you can't end on an ellipsis. I'm like,
oh, yes, I can. Oh, sure, and then a preposition and an ellipsis. I'll throw brackets in there.
A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, ellipsis, we were raised on this, back to Gen X. We can go with an ellipsis. It's not going to kill anybody that,
No, you got to have fun, man. That's one thing that I'm really, this is not on topic per se, but life should be fun. We're here once. We should enjoy it.
Throw in a compound sentence. Make the sentence too long. Yeah, compound it three times. Make it that you have to read it twice. Sure, why not?
Give me the run-on one sentence paragraph that says exactly what you want and tells me how to say it as I read it. Don't just give me the bullet points.
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. We're a little low on time, but let's do so quickly. A thing that you and I are both now members of, which is Farcaster. So if you don't know, Farcaster is a protocol of sorts, a decentralized approach to building social applications. It's a little bit similar to Noster, and it just raised, Jason, $150 million. And the TechCrunch headline is that it has about 80,000 daily users. So I am not sure how to square those numbers.
Okay. It is obviously getting some level of traction. And it does seem like the crypto technology isn't as difficult to use. So you download their app in the App Store, you pay $5 to create your account. Then it start. Then all of a sudden, it starts getting annoying. Like you try to join a channel, it's like, "Hey, I have some gas fees, and I will get, or buy some of these Zooms or Wows or whatever." And I'm like, "Oh my god, yeah, you just killed it for me. I don't want to be involved in tokens. I don't want to have to pay tokens. This it's just too complicated, right? Compared to Instagram, TikTok, Twitter X, like so. But there is some value to not being locked into one social graph. The problem with that is that's not a problem for 99% of users." So the people who embrace these kind of things are weirdos, you know, intellectuals, you know, hacktivists, whatever. And that's all great. I'm in that cohort. I like this kind of stuff. What's notable here is Fred Wilson. Fred Wilson moved his blog onto a decentralized blog. He moved his tweets or social posts onto this. So he's going full decentralized. The idea being, you can kind of own his stuff. It's on the blockchain. It's immutable. Can't change it, I guess. Where if you change it, the change is perfectly done there. That's problematic because sometimes people write things that they want to go away. Almost everybody who's been on Twitter for over 10 years archives their first 10 years because it was a chat room and like, who knows what you said, you know, about whatever topic that now would get you canceled. But 10 years ago was like perfectly valid. Like, so what's notable here also is the valuation is $1 billion for 350,000 users who paid $5 each. It's 1,000 times revenue, maybe, or 700 times revenue. There's no logic here to this, or there's no obvious logic here to the scale of this bet. I don't know why they need 150 million. Not 25 million. I don't know why it needs to be $1 billion valuation. I think it has to be $1 billion valuation because this entrepreneur did a great job fundraising. But how do you make a return on this? It would have to have, I don't know, if these users are worth $5 each.
Let's say 15, just to throw them the benefit of the doubt. Okay. You still need such an amazing amount of users on this to make it math out. And as we've seen from X and Snap and so forth, Pinterest, you know, if you are not the leading social network, the power law hits you pretty hard. And I think that the total possible DAUs for a Twitter-ish service with some blockchain elements that costs $5 to use is not big enough to make those numbers work out. I just don't understand the amount of capital that people put into this. Like, I mean, I could see 15, but 150?
Makes no sense. But congratulations to the founder.
Dan, good job, Dan. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know him personally, and he's said a couple of like kind of slight digs to me on his podcast. I know because people send them to me. The interesting thing about it is, let's take another at scale social network and look at their valuation.
Sure.
Reddit.
Sure.
Been worth $6 to $9 billion since it's been public.
Mm-hmm.
Think they're right about $1 billion in revenue. Okay. If one has a million, one has $1 billion in revenue worth $9 billion, nine times top line revenue. Mm-hmm. Most people would say Reddit is massively overvalued. At this point in time. That is no dig to Reddit. I spend a lot of time on Reddit.
Me too. You
can look up my handle. I love Reddit. I'm in my headphone and audiophile phase. Man, Reddit is awesome. I'm on headphones, cheap headphones, headphone advice, music. I'm having a delightful time in Reddit at scale. Reddit is worth a million times what Farcaster is worth. Like, it's got $1 billion in revenue. It's got 1,000 times the revenue, probably. So.
And it has a lot of users. So weekly active unique users were up 40% year over year in the first quarter of Reddit to 306 million. Dailies were 82.7 million, up 37%. And it's worth $9 billion. So just 9x, but like tens of thousands of times more people.
Well, actually, we could do that with I love back of the envelope math. If it's an $8 billion, $9 billion company with 90 million people a day, that is 100 times The valuation is 100 times the daily active users.
Right.
Interesting. It is 30 times the weekly active users. And do you know what the monthly users are? It's a lot more, yeah.
They don't break out monthly, I don't think. I think it's just daily and weekly in their IR.
Yeah. Okay, so their weekly is 30 times. Like, so we actually kind of have a way to benchmark these with revenue, dailies, weekly. So for somebody who's watching this and trying to understand the major difference here, the major difference is one of them is a publicly traded company that's very well established and predictable. This one is not predictable yet. It's a Hail Mary moonshot.
Yeah.
Could distributed or will distributed, permissionless, nobody owns it, systems be worth more than ones that are completely owned and controlled? And that's my question for you. What's a more valuable asset? One where one person, a CEO and a board and shareholders control it, and one where you don't? Which is worth more?
In the history of business up until this moment, Jason, what is the leading way to both safeguard and extend shareholder value? It is centralized top-down authority. It is there's a reason why a DAO doesn't run Microsoft. Satya does.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a lot of technology and interesting social and philosophical commentary to be made about decentralized systems that's really fun. I just don't see how you can say Reddit's worth $9.3 billion now, whatever it is. This is going to be worth more than that in time, given the way it's set up and the technology it's using. And I think the issue here is your Andreessen Horowitz cryptos, maybe your Paradigms, maybe your Han Ventures. I think they raised a lot of money and they had to put it to work. And so going back to your point about big funds and big checks. Yeah, I don't think there's that many breakout consumer facing crypto apps that have 80,000 DAUs that are non-speculative or token-based. So if you see one, you want to make sure that you have a big chunk of it. And I think that's what happened here. Again, shout out Dan. If someone wanted to give me $150 million for my Substack, yes, I'm in.
And you have to also have the humility to know, as an investor who didn't review the deck here, I don't know what the underpinnings here or what their vision is. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't have, you know, certainly we don't have full visibility. So maybe there's something in the pitch that Fred Wilson saw or Andreessen saw that's unbelievable.
Yes.
But I'm going to go with your take on this, which is there's not that many crypto deals. There's a lot of crypto money out there. I saw this when it came to investing in, you know, sustainable companies, right? And it turns out there just aren't that many people doing alternative energy, sustainable companies. Therefore, the ones that do exist were priced, in my mind, 10x their performance.
Yeah.
So, and so you say, well, why is that? Well, because there are so many people doing climate, carbon, you know, funds, and there's so few entrepreneurs, you know.
Yep. It's tough. But I will say, I don't think we're ever going to see multi-billion dollar crypto. Well, not never, but I think the era of multi-billion dollar crypto funds is probably behind us, just because I think this round is a good example of that. But I do think we should not get into the whole congressional crypto thing until the vote's clear there. So we'll bring that up.
Yeah, we'll bring that up on the next news program for sure. Alex has a new newsletter. So subscribe to Alex's newsletter. Let's get a shout out to your newsletter. What's it called? How do they find it?
Cautiousoptimism.news. I managed to make a website work. I'm very proud of myself. I got the DNS all humming.
Cautious optimism dot news.
Yeah.
I like it. Because you are not a cynical anti-tech individual. You don't hate big tech.
No, but I am. Okay. I am on the side of things who I don't hate big tech, but also I don't think Microsoft should have been able to buy Blizzard. But I'm also excited about new technology. And a little skeptical of humane AI. So to me, it's like, let's find a little middle ground between Lina Khan and the Mark Andreessen manifesto about how if we slow down AI, you're a murderer. Somewhere in between those two, you know? That's the goal.
So you want to call balls and strikes, like just be even-handed in your newsletter using Beehive or Substack. I know that's a big thing for people
Substack,
to make a decision.
I stayed on Substack. I canceled my Beehive sub. I talked to the CEO about that. They're lovely. Tyler's great, but I just Substack simple.
Okay. I'm fascinated by Beehive. There's some features on there I'm understanding are really good. So I'm going to test it.
The ad network at Beehive is their key feature. It's great.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what happened? I was like, I had so many antiquated mailing lists that we'd accumulated over the years.
Yeah.
It costed me a lot of money on MailChimp. And then it was free to put them on Substack. And then it's like close to free on Beehive. Uh-huh. So this whole idea that you have like a, you know, you did some event 10 years ago, a launch festival.
Sure.
You got 10,000 emails on the list and you're paying $50 a month to store it. And then you have 10 events and now you're paying $500 a month to store it. You can actually just move it to these services for free. Uh-huh. And that's, again, why efficiency is going way up and costs are coming way down. Things are getting cheaper. The world's getting better. Be cautiously optimistic, everybody, and sign up right now. Cautiously optimistic.news. Follow x.com/Alex. I'm x.com/Jason. We're going to see you next time on This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.